I thought I'd start with myself and then talk about the Buddha, because you're probably wondering why I'm a Buddhist. You might have thought I'm much too tall to be a Buddhist. And I became a Buddhist because I realized I was going to die. And it's not morbid, it's just sort of realistic. You know, I was born a Lutheran, but it wasn't my fault. And it was fine for a while. But then I went to high school in the 60s. And it was important to question all authority and not trust anyone over 30, so I joined the bandwagon and became an agnostic. I said to myself, there's probably something, but I don't need to define it now. And then I turned 30 and realized that I was going to die. I was sort of depressed for 2 years, from 28 to 30. I stopped smoking. I joined a gym. You know, I quit my job. I did a road trip. And just to sort of make sense of what life was all about. When I came back to L.A. and started to work again, I said, I'm going to find a religion so I can die well. I figured that was the job of religion. And so I bought a book by Houston Smith called World Religions, and I read the chapter on Buddhism twice. And then I found a phone book and a meditation center, and I started to meditate. And it was one of the most difficult things I'd ever tried to do. I was in fairly good shape after working out at the gym, but all my muscles were really tight, and I couldn't sit on the ground comfortably. My little legs were all sort of scrunched, and I couldn't stop my mind. It was just agitated by, why am I doing this? What's the point? I could be watching something on TV, you know. And yet, when I heard my teacher, Shinzen, his birth name was Stephen Young, and he had been going to UCLA and went to Japan to study the Japanese language, and ended up being ordained as a Shingon monk. Go figure. And he became Shinzen Young instead of Stephen Young. And he ended up at the International Buddhist Meditation Center where I now live. So he was my introduction to Buddhism. It was this American guy who had become ordained as a Buddhist monk. And English was his first language. English is my only language. So we were able to sort of dialogue at times. And occasionally I understood what he was talking about. But most of the time I didn't, and it frustrated me because I wanted to see the world the way he did. He talked about the transparency of things, and I'm thinking, gosh, if I meditate, I can see through things. Wouldn't that be great? You know, and how consciousness creates the whole world. And, you know, I thought God created the whole world. And I'm going, okay, if I keep meditating, I'll be able to understand what the heck he's talking about. And sure enough, that seemed to be the case, but it required me to do a lot of reading as well. And then after about 2 years with Shinzen as my primary teacher, I wanted a more orthodox approach to Buddhism. And so I said, I want to study what the Buddha talked about, not what Japan talked about. So the Buddha was born in India, and that tradition is called Theravada, Doctrine of the Elders. And I asked Shinzen if he knew of any monks practicing that tradition. He said, yes, right on Crenshaw Boulevard, Dr. Ratanasara at the Dharma Vijaya Buddhist Vihara. Big mouthful to say. And I'm going, okay. So I went over there on Crenshaw Boulevard, knocked on the door. Dr. Ratanasara answered. I said, I'd like to be your student and take some of your classes. He said, come back next Wednesday. I said, okay. So I came back and I was the only student. So it was me and Dr. Ratanasara sitting at a table, and the first book we used was called the Vasuddhimagga, the Path of Purification. It's an ancient text in English, available today, 900 pages. It's sort of the Reader's Digest version of the entire Buddhist path. It's very dry reading. And we sat side by side, and I would read a page, and he would say, do you have any questions? I said, no. And then I'd read another page. Do you have any questions? And that's how it sort of worked. Now the kind of questions I had were, did you guys have toothbrushes back then? You know, because I'm thinking, how did the Buddhist monks clean their teeth 2,500 years ago? And as it turns out, they did. But it didn't have much to do with my salvation or enlightenment. I was more interested in just how the whole thing worked. And he was so kind. You know, he didn't make fun of me, and he answered all my questions in a serious way. And he was my teacher up until he died, up until the year 2000. So I have to warn you that even though I'm ordained in the Vietnamese Zen tradition, my knowledge is pretty much in early Buddhism. So using a Christian model, I think like a Catholic and I dress like a Protestant. So if you can deal with that, we're going to make a lot of progress. So I continued to practice and study, and it started to make more and more sense. And then one day, Dr. Ratnasar said, did you ever think about being ordained? And I said, oh, no, that means you can't have any more sex. And who wants to do that, you know? And he chuckled because he had never had any sex. He became ordained at 14 in Sri Lanka. So he couldn't quite understand what the big deal was about having sex. And but then he said to me, he said, you know, you don't have much of a career. You've never been married. You seem to really like Buddhism. You know, why not take a chance? Why not do something you really like? That way you'll never have to work another day in your life. And I said, wow, I'll never have to work again if I do something I like. So it started to make more and more sense. And in 1994, I became a novice monk. And in 1996, I took my full ordination and became a fully ordained American Buddhist monk. And then I said to myself, well, what am I going to do? What do Buddhist monks do in America? You know, do we sit and meditate all day? Do we read a lot? Do we think? Do we talk? What do we do? And I got a phone call from Deacon Szymanski from L.A. County State Prison for Men. And he said, Reverend Kusla, there was an article in the paper, and I got your phone number, and I was just wondering if you'd be interested in being a volunteer at the prison to talk to the Buddhist prisoners about meditation and the Dharma. And I said, you mean there are Buddhists in prison? You know, all the books I read didn't lead me to believe that Buddhists ended up there. But there are a lot of Buddhists in prison. And so for a year, I rode my motorcycle to Lancaster, California. Now, at that time, I couldn't afford a car. The car I own now, I bought on Craigslist for cash. It runs pretty good. It's a little ugly, but it's okay. And I'm thinking to myself, gosh, that's a long way to go. That's an hour and a half each way on a motorcycle. And that's upper desert, which is like going to hell, you know, because it's colder in the winter and hotter in the summer, and the wind is always blowing. But I committed myself to a year, and I learned a lot about what happens when you take women and children out of community. There are no soft and round edges, and that's what the prison is all about. It's all about guys, 4,300 guys. Jeez. And so I went to the chapel, and, you know, and this was a community chapel, so all the religions used the same chapel. I was bringing up Buddhist books for a while, but they kept disappearing. We couldn't find what religion was stealing our books. So we decided to assign one of the prisoners as a librarian, and we kept all the Buddhist books in his cell, and then he would, you know, sign them out and get them back. I brought up incense so the prisoners could meditate, and it turned out they sold it, and they have a whole underground economy I wasn't aware of in prison. So I learned as I went and started to see that Buddhism, more than anything else, is designed to help us end our suffering. And that's what the Buddha did. He figured out a way to end human suffering, which is just, for me, an amazing thing to do. So after a year there, I spent 5 years at Central Juvenile Hall as a volunteer, working with the young people. I remember I asked this girl, she was about 15 years old, I said, what do you miss most about being in juvenile hall? She said, I miss carbonation. We don't have any Cokes here. And I'm going, isn't it weird what we miss the most when we can't get it, you know? I saw that children suffered just as much as adults. and oftentimes were more confused. But I felt that children had a chance to become more skillful. And sometimes adults didn't have enough time left to become skillful. But of course, in Buddhism, we have many lifetimes. So maybe in the next lifetime, they'd be more skillful. I'm at UCLA. I've been there for 8 years now as a Buddhist chaplain, and we have a Buddhist club that meets every Tuesday in the Catholic Center. Now, the Catholics and the Buddhists have been getting along pretty well since the Second Vatican Council, because during the Second Vatican Council, the bishop signed this document called Nostra Aetate, and in that document, it said Buddhism was okay. How cool is that? And so ever since then, we've been in dialogue. And today, I was just at Loyola Marymount University for our monthly Buddhist-Catholic dialogue. And we talked about environmental issues. How do Buddhists approach environment? How do Catholics approach the environment? So being at UCLA is exciting because young people have a lot of questions, an awful lot of energy, and a lot of life yet to live. And so I try to share with them some of the insights I've had. This past Tuesday, I talked about Voluntary Simplicity, which was a book published first in 1981, republished in 1993 by Duane Elgin. And he talked about voluntary simplicity as a way of life and almost a spiritual path. And so one of the students said, well, how as a student could I simplify my life? What would I need to do? And I said, well, there are two things you could start off with. First thing is get rid of all your credit cards. Second thing is don't use your cell phone. Well, they didn't hear another word I said the whole night. So I realized that maybe it's the wrong message for their age group. Because us older people have actually given them the charge cards. And now we've given them cell phones. And so telling them not to use them doesn't seem to be the right approach. But it's so much fun to be at UCLA, and I learned so much about myself as well. I'm also on the Spiritual Care Committee at the UCLA Medical Center, and I give presentations to the new chaplains on Buddhist patient care and end-of-life issues. They don't have any full-time Buddhist chaplains at UCLA, and unfortunately, Buddhists get sick just like everybody else. So the approach I want is sort of a non-theistic approach to patient health care. And that can come as a shock to some who think that God is important. And most people in America, of course, do. But there is a whole bunch of non-theists out there. We've got the atheists, we've got the agnostics, we've got the secular humanists, we've got the Buddhists. So their voice needs to be heard as well. And I find sometimes I turn out to be the voice. And so I need to be careful in how I present non-theism, not to scare anybody away. And this past Monday, I found myself in Santa Ana at a theater arts high school, speaking to the religion club during their lunch hour. And one of the things I said, which I sort of regret now, is I said to them, what's the one thing that God can't do? What's the one thing that God can't do? And their jaws dropped and their eyes opened up. You mean there's something that God can't do? I said, yes. He can't end suffering. And they just sort of paused a moment, but I don't think it clicked. And I realized that I needed to be a bit more gentle in my approach and more subtle, because these poor high school students, I'm just thinking, they're going to look at Buddhism now as just being this sort of like cult, you know? And what's wrong with us? So as I go out in the community, as I venture out there to see how many different ways humans can suffer, I learn a lot about myself. And I learn about how important it is to have Buddhism in the world and to have Buddhism in America. So let me talk a little bit about the Buddha now, because I think he was a cool guy. And one of the things that attracted me to Buddhism was the fact that he never talked to God. And that may sound like really a weird thing, but you know, I've never had a relationship with God. I must say, even being born a Lutheran, the door wasn't open to me. And when I hear voices in my head, I get nervous. I don't think they're divine. And so, as I approached Buddhism, I saw this was a human being who believed in gods, small g-s, and found them to be useful. But found that they couldn't end suffering. And until I became a Buddhist, I didn't know I was suffering. My life was pretty good. And then I realized how difficult my life was after I started to get involved in Buddhism. So what did the Buddha see? Well, the story, the legend of the Buddha sort of goes like this. He was born a prince. His dad was a king. His mom was a queen. His dad wanted him to take over the family business, run the kingdom. He was brought up in sort of an insulated way. He had the best food and the best clothing. They didn't have any boom boxes or CDs back then, so he had real dancing girls playing instruments. And when I first read that, I'm going, that guy had it made, didn't he? And he was taught the art of war because he came from the warrior caste. And then something dramatic happened to him, according to the legend story of the Buddha. He asked his charioteer, Chana, to take him into the streets of the city because he'd been kept secluded for such a long time. He wanted to see where all the laughter came from, where the crying came from, what the business was like out there. And that's when he saw the four signs. The four signs are an old person, a sick person, a dead person, a holy person. So I'm reading the story of the Buddha, and I'm thinking to myself, he never saw old people. He never saw sick people. He never saw dead people. How could that be? And then I thought about me. And I thought about what my culture does for me. It's the exact same thing his parents did for him. That if somebody gets really old, we sort of put them in rest homes, you know? And only friends and relatives get to see them. If somebody gets really sick, we put them at UCLA Medical Center, if we have health insurance. And only friends and relatives get to see them. If somebody gets really dead, we buy them some new clothes, you know? Paint their face, comb their hair, cover them with flowers so we can't smell the decaying flesh. And there is Uncle Max. Looks like he's just sleeping. Death isn't so bad. So we're prevented from seeing the reality of our life, I think, in the same way the Buddha was prevented from seeing the reality of his life. And then he saw the holy person. He saw the yogi. He saw the mendicant. And he realized in the midst of all the suffering that he had just experienced in one day in the city, this man was calm and peaceful and serene in spite of it all. And I think that planted a seed in the future Buddha that the religious path had the answers, the big answers to life, you know? But there was one very important thing he needed to do. He needed to have a kid so he could have an heir to the throne. And for some reason, it doesn't go into great detail, it took him until the age of 29 to have his first child, a boy, whom they called Rahula. Now, the word Rahula means fetter or impediment. And I don't know many parents who would name their firstborn a fetter. But in the story of the Buddha, it works well, doesn't it? Because there's such a strong attachment that parents have to children. Such a strong attachment that on the very day of their child's birth, he left. He left his wife and his child in the care of his parents. And he went to the edge of the forest, and he took off all his clothes and cut off all his hair. And he picked up these old rags that were lying next to his feet on a path, it said, and tied them together and covered his naked body. And for 6 years he practiced asceticism, renunciation, meditation. He was giving up all the things that made him comfortable. He wanted to see where suffering came from. This was his chance. He had lived a comfortable lifestyle. He didn't have as much suffering as others, but he still sensed it was there under the surface. So what did he do? He found it. He found the cause of his suffering. But it took him a lot of time and effort. And when I read some of the ascetic practices that he did, it said in the Pali Canon. Pali Canon is the early Buddhist scriptures. I couldn't believe it. I'm thinking there's no human beings that are doing this now. It's just a legend. It's just a story. And then I visited the sagely city of 10,000 Buddhas in Ukiah, California. This is a Chinese Buddhist monastery. They bought the California Mental Hospital and turned it into a Buddhist monastery. The energy is about the same, I must say. You know, and at this temple, at this monastery, the monks and nuns do not lie down at night to go to sleep. They sleep sitting up in full lotus posture. They only have one meal a day, and it's vegetarian. And I noticed a lot of them were really tired when I was there. And I'm thinking, why? Why would they do that? And how could they do that? And it seems they're doing that because they want to see where suffering comes from. Where does it come from? And they're exploring it in a very personal way. So as it turns out, the ascetic practices that the Buddha did turned out to be true. That there are people today in California practicing the same stuff. Searching out the reason for their suffering. Working on the solution to their suffering. Using the Eightfold Path. So here was the Buddha working hard, almost getting it, had many teachers, always surpassed his teachers. I like that part of the story. You know, and they asked him, hey, can you join me? Can you be a co-teacher with me? Because you're really good. And he says, no, this isn't it. This didn't bring me permanent peace. This isn't it yet. So now, after 6 years, he's 99% of the way to his enlightenment. He's almost there. He's almost got it. He asked his teachers, how do I get the last 1%? Couldn't tell him. Don't know. He asked other people who were practicing for years and years and years, longer than he had been, how do I get the last 1%? Nobody knew. There wasn't one person enlightened in the world at that time, 2,500 years ago. So it said, in a very dramatic way, he sat beneath a tree, which later became called the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. And he said, I'm going to sit here and get enlightened, or I'm going to die trying. And thankfully for Buddhism, he didn't die. He continued, and it said, according to the Theravada tradition, I've got to be specific now because there are many different kinds of traditions in Buddhism, and they all have different parts of the story laid out. 7 days and seven nights it took the Buddha, according to this one tradition, to achieve his perfection. He became a perfect human being in his enlightenment, in his nirvana. He never had to suffer again while he was alive. He ended his karma, and he would never be reborn again because of his nirvana. An amazing feat. Now, if you read further into the story, it said for 550 lifetimes he had been reborn as a bodhisattva, one who was practicing. And it wasn't until the last lifetime as Siddhartha Gautama that he finally achieved his perfection. So it's not a one-lifetime deal. That we don't know how long we've been practicing already. This may be the life, this may not be the life. But the idea, I suppose, is to keep practicing. So what did he achieve? How can we make sense out of this term nirvana? What are Buddhists trying to achieve? Every school of Buddhism has this in common, that nirvana is the goal. Is there a way to turn off the buzzing? Do you think? Okay. Okay. I was thinking it's a little creature in there someplace, you know? Okay, thank you. So, he explained exactly what he achieved in his first talk called the Dhamma Chaka Pavatana Sutta, the turning of the wheel talk. He said, I have discovered four truths, four universal truths. The first truth I have discovered is that life is ultimately unsatisfactory. Why? Because we're born. If we weren't born, we'd never get old, we'd never get sick, and we'd never die. If that's not bad enough, he said, everything that we love, cherish, and want to hold on to will be taken away from us. And the culprit is impermanence and change. And he continued with, there are people in this world we don't like and places in this world we don't want to be in, and we are around those people and in those places, and there's nothing we can do about it. So he said, life sucks. Now, this is a tough message to hear the first time if you think life is good. You know, and if I go to Palos Verdes and speak to the high school up there overlooking the ocean, man, you know, I mean, life sucks because they lost the football game. So, okay, yeah. So there are different levels of discomfort. There are different levels of suffering. We don't all suffer at the same level. But it's always just under the surface, that sort of dis-ease, that that uncomfortable feeling that it could be better and there's no way to change it. That we, for some reason, lack the ability to bring all the component parts together to have perfection in this lifetime, no matter how hard we try. So that was the first truth, that it's not always unsatisfactory, but it's ultimately unsatisfactory. The second truth is, the reason life is so unsatisfactory is because we're selfish. All we think about is us, every day, every moment. We're trying to hold on to the good stuff and push away the bad stuff. But because we're born with spiritual ignorance, we never get it right. We don't see the world the way it really is. We're asleep at the wheel, you might say. The third truth is nirvana. The third truth is the answer. The third truth is the end of suffering, the end of rebirth, the end of karma. And the fourth truth is the Noble Eightfold Path, the way leading to nirvana. And the Noble Eightfold Path works like this. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now I'm recording this, so you can go back and listen to it later. We can take those eight path factors and put them into three categories. Personal discipline, mental purification, and wisdom. I'm going to talk about the first category tonight. Next week, I'm going to talk in great detail about the second category, which is meditation and mental purification. And then third week, I'm going to talk about the last two aspects, which are the wisdom aspects, and how to apply Buddhism to everyday life. So to get into the moral aspects, which is one of my favorite things to talk about, it seems to me that's the one thing all religions have in common, is morality. And yet, how often do we hear people talking about it anymore? Rarely. Nobody wants to hear somebody talk about morality. You know, what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. But in Buddhism, that's where we start. That's the beginning of the Buddhist path. So what path factors do we find in that first category of personal discipline? We find right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right speech, the Buddha said, has four parts. And he always goes sort of towards the negative. He says, right speech is don't speak in a harsh way, a malicious way, a false way, and don't get involved in gossip or idle chatter. Those four things always increase suffering. So I'm thinking about this, and right speech is really difficult to monitor because I find I speak a lot. I'm invited to speak a lot. How lucky am I? But that gives me the opportunity of really messing up, saying something that I can't take back once it manifests in the world around me. So that's why, as a Buddhist, I have chosen to accept the five precepts as the foundation of my practice. Let me talk a little bit about those, and then we'll get into right speech. The five precepts, they are not commandments. One of the things that I found interesting about Buddhism is we do not have right and wrong in Buddhism. We do not have good or bad in Buddhism. And why is that? Because we lack a divine lawgiver who defines for us what is right and what is wrong. As a Buddhist, I look at right and wrong as being very arbitrary. You know, in the 70s, we were driving at 55 because we had a gas shortage. Okay, so it was wrong to drive at 65. Now, if you drive at 65, you run over. So this right and wrong seems to be by consensus sometimes, by necessity sometimes, but for a Buddhist, never divinely inspired. So what do we have instead of right and wrong? We have skillful and unskillful. What's our reference point? More suffering or less suffering? When I was a volunteer at Central Juvenile Hall, I never saw one evil kid. Not one. I saw a bunch of unskillful children who needed to learn new skills to be invited back into community. If you don't have evil, and by the way, if you take the word evil and put a D in front of evil, you got the devil. You take the word good and take one of the O's out, you got God. Pretty heavy stuff. But when you got skillful and unskillful, you got a chance. You got a chance to be better. I like that idea. So here I'm looking at the five precepts of a Buddhist. not commandments. These are training precepts. They go like this. I choose to train myself not to kill. I choose to train myself not to take what is not given. I choose to train myself not to indulge in sexual misconduct. I choose to train myself not to lie. I choose to train myself not to consume intoxicants. Those are the five training precepts of a Buddhist. That's where you start. What do those precepts do? They change your karma. Buddhism, more than anything else, is designed to change your karma. So let me talk a little bit about karma and connect that to these five precepts. Anybody seen the TV show My Name is Earl? Okay, all about karma, isn't it? Isn't that a great show? How far have we come when a popular TV show is all about karma? Times are changing. So, karma is everything we think, everything we say, and everything we do. That is karma. The results, the consequences of karma, in Pali, the canonical language of early Buddhism, is called vipaka. Karma, vipaka, cause and consequence. I don't think, from what I've read, that we can create energy. I don't think we create karma. I think we transform karma. I look at myself as a transformer. We have this raw energy in the world. And every time I think, I'm taking energy and I'm transforming it. And in Buddhism, we give it a skillful or unskillful value. Every time I say something, I'm taking this raw energy, this neutral energy, and transforming it into skillful, unskillful. And every time I do something, I'm doing the same thing. So now, how do I judge if I'm being skillful or unskillful? My reference point is how my life is doing. Does my life suck? I need to have better karma. I better get out and do something. I need to take a proactive approach because my future depends on what I do right now. We don't have fatalism in Buddhism. We have an opportunity to be connected and empowered by life, by changing it for the better, by reducing suffering. But we have to do it. Now, again, this is an early Buddhist orthodox approach. There's a great level of accountability in early Buddhism. We don't have any divine intervention. We don't petition the bodhisattvas, the Buddha saints, to help us. We look at our life and say, what do I need to do to make it better? And generally, we can start today by speaking more skillfully and acting more skillfully. It takes a long time to think more skillfully, I must say. So when I was at juvenile hall, I would talk to the young people and I'd say, you want to have a better life right now? Say please and thank you to the staff. Your life will change right now. That's what my mom told me. That's what the Buddha told me too. Must be right. So they could change their life right now and suffer less by being more skillful in what they said. And then that could materialize in being more skillful in what they did. These five precepts, choosing not to kill, choosing not to take what is not given, choosing not to indulge in sexual misconduct, choosing not to lie, choosing not to consume intoxicants, transforms our karma. And now the results of that transformation is less suffering. Meditation is transformation of mind. The Buddha said our mind leads our speech and action into the world. So the first step is what we say and what we do. The second step is what we think. And the third step, hopefully, is wisdom and compassion. So, right speech. Those four aspects of right speech. I was talking to one of the students on Tuesday, and I said, you know, if you need to use your cell phone, take a Buddhist approach. And they said, well, what's that? I said, well, think about it. You know, think about not saying anything false, malicious, harsh, or involving yourself in gossip or idle chatter. Then talk on your cell phone. They said, what am I going to say? Well, that's sort of the point. We say a lot of unnecessary things all the time. And I think with the invention of the cell phone, it's just magnified. And you're going, wow, what happened to silence? You know? I mean, you know, Paul Simon wrote a whole song about it. And I don't hear it anymore. I don't hear the silence anymore. I'm walking down the street, I hear people talking. You know? And they're talking to the electronic voices being created in their head by this little thing in their hand. It's not real. I was at an interreligious gathering in Garden Grove. And one of the evangelical preachers was at the table I was sitting at. And I saw his eyes get real big. And he looked up to the heavens. And he said, "Do you hear it?" I said, "What?" He says, "I'm not sure, but..." And as it turned out, the intercom was on and there was a speaker in the ceiling. But he thought God was speaking. And I'm thinking, yeah, we're so electronically manipulated these days that any voice we hear, you know, man. In Buddhism, we hear those voices, it's a distraction. We go on to the next thing, you know, whatever that might be. So right speech is so important. Wars have started because of speech. Wars have ended because of speech. And that most of us don't even think before we speak, it seems to me. I know I find myself in that situation. Right action. The Buddha said there were three kinds of action that always increase suffering. Killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Now the problem with killing, it seems to me, is that it's really hard to be born. How long was it before you were here? You know? And how long will it be until you come back? Well, if you're a Christian, this may be it. You got one shot. You got maybe 70 years to get it right, and you're looking at eternity. So I might say to you, good luck, and what took you so long to get here? If you're a Hindu, I might say, hey, welcome back, good to see you again. You know, and if you're a Buddhist, I might say, good rebirth, human being, very cool. You know, so not being here allows us not to find the Dharma, not to practice the Dharma, and not to find our salvation. So it's important that when we're born as a human being, to take advantage of that miracle. And it is a miracle. In one of the Buddhist texts, it talks about how hard it is to be born as a human being. And there's an example is a large lake with a one-eyed turtle who every 100 years comes up to take a breath of air. In this lake is a wooden yoke that had been on an oxen floating. The chances of the one-eyed turtle coming up for the breath of air in the middle of the wooden yoke is the chance we have being born a human being. It's so difficult. And we take it for granted. And yet when I look around, I'm thinking, the wars, the cars, the guns, you know, life doesn't seem to have much value at all. And it's so hard to acquire. How can we change that? Well, for me, death is my co-pilot. He sits right here all the time. And he's always looking for me. He's always looking out for me. He's just waiting till I make some big mistake. Like walking against the light, you know? And he'll smile, too. Say, this could be it. I'm going to get you. And so when I found that death was my co-pilot, and I found out that life was a miracle and special, I get up a little earlier each day just because of that. And I stay up a little later each night just because of that. Because I don't know if I'm going to be able to get all my stuff done before tomorrow. And I might not be here. And I got a lot of stuff to do. I just started to learn how to play mandolin. I'm going like crazy. So I'm either worried about death or arthritis, one of the two. So I'm practicing every day, you know. So life is a miracle. And if we take a life, we prevent them from achieving their realization as a human being. And they may not come back. They may have lost their opportunity. So not taking life is the first part. It's the first precept, but it's the first part about wrong action. I had a high school student say, well, how do you practice not killing? What's the secret? What's the Buddhist technique? And I said to him, well, start big. Wake up tomorrow morning and say to yourself, today I'm not killing any human beings. And you walk out that door with the confidence on your face that you can make it through the whole day and not take anybody out. Most of them did it. Then I said, when you get really good at not killing human beings, then go after lions and tigers and bears and say to yourself, today I'm not killing any lions or tigers or bears either. And you make it through the whole day and don't kill any of them either. When you get really good at not killing, then you include mosquitoes and flies, cockroaches and spiders. And those are so hard not to kill, because that's the easiest solution, isn't it? You don't want to catch them and take all that time to put them outside. A mosquito's buzzing your ear at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're thinking, well, if I'm practicing not killing, what do I need to do? Maybe I could buy a mosquito net, you know, and just live in harmony with the mosquito. He on the outside, I'm on the inside. So by practicing that precept, it allows us in a very real way to see the value in each and every life, from the smallest to the biggest. Not taking what is not given. We have a problem in America, I think, and this is my own personal perspective. We have given up our citizenship and we have become consumers. And it is so important to own stuff. And when I became a Buddhist monk, I said to myself, I have to practice asceticism. I'm going to give a lot of my stuff away or sell it at a reduced price. So I had like a guitar and a keyboard and 500 blues albums that I had acquired over many years. And I saw these as being hindrances to my salvation and my enlightenment. And other people could use them and gain pleasure from them. And so I sold them or gave them away. And I sort of moved into my little room at IBMC down the way there. And there I was. And 10 years later, I've got a guitar and a mandolin, and I have MP3s. I don't have CDs anymore, or albums. And I'm thinking, it all came back to me. How do you get rid of stuff if you're a consumer? And then it dawned on me. The problem is not stuff. The problem is the want. If you have wants, stuff will materialize. So don't get rid of your stuff. Get rid of your wants. And then the stuff is no problem. And then I'm looking at, well, what is a good want and what isn't a good want? And then I looked at the wants and put them into needs and wants. So what do we need as a human being? Because we don't want to give the stuff up that we need. And then I looked at the Buddha and said, well, what did the Buddha say about needs? What are the requisites of a human being? And he said something very specifically about the requisites of a monk or a nun. And there are four of them. They are food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. Those are your needs as a human being. And basically, the other stuff is just our wants. A lot of people are working on those needs. A lot of people have two or three of the needs, but not all four. Healthcare is tough to come by these days. So they may spend their whole life just working on the needs. There are some lucky people, some gifted people who have met their needs, and now are working on their wants. And the thing I find about wants, endless, infinite. Never ultimately satisfied. There's always another want to take its place of the want you satisfy. So I see this problem of ownership in a very interesting way. That if I think I own something and somebody takes it from me, that increases my suffering dramatically. And if I take something from someone who thinks they own it, then their suffering is increased. And it became clear to me in the mid-80s, because I had just bought my first brand new car, an Opel Manta, flag blue, four on the floor, audio cassette radio combination right in the dashboard. It felt like a Mercedes to me. And I'm driving around Los Angeles feeling the best. And then somebody one night stole my audio cassette radio out of the dashboard. And there it was, broken window, hole in the dashboard. And I come out to go to work, and I am surprised. And then that surprise turns to anger and hatred. And I curse my car. And I say, car, who owns you? Who's making your payments? Who washes you every weekend, car? And I listen carefully for a response, and my car said nothing back. And I realized my car didn't know I owned it. My car didn't even know I used it. So this thing of ownership created a whole lot of suffering for me. Thankfully, I had insurance and I got the radio replaced. So the story ended in a nice way. But it became apparent to me that my issue was ownership. As long as we have the illusion of ownership, we're going to suffer. And if we take things from people who think they own stuff, they're going to suffer. So, as a Buddhist, we practice not taking what is not given. The third one is sexual misconduct. And this is a real tough one in Los Angeles because, you know what? Everything is okay in L.A. And I'm just looking around, and when I was in high school, half the stuff we did wasn't okay, and the other half we felt guilty about. Their times have changed. And now everybody's trying to find their sexual identity. If only they can achieve that, they'll be happy and satisfied for the rest of their life. And here comes the Buddha. And he makes every monk and nun celibate. And you go, but why? What's the problem with sex? Well, the Buddha, when he thought about monks and nuns, was very specific. He said, one of the problems with sex for a monk is the fact that you live on donations. You live in an economy of generosity. You have to have a small lifestyle in order to be supported by donations. You can't have a lot of stuff. You can't have a lot of wants and needs. And if you're involved in sexual activity, it's not a simple lifestyle. Number one. So for a monk, we want to have a simple lifestyle. But number two, the most important part of this whole thing, if you're involved in sexual activity, you will never be free. You will be happy. You will be momentarily satisfied. You might be in love, but you will never be free. And the goal of Buddhism is to be free. Wow. But how about if you're not a monk or a nun and don't want to be free and want to have sex? Well, the Buddha implied in everything he said about sex, he said the activity of sex will never ultimately satisfy the desire for sex. Man, that is a bummer. That means you can have sex 1,000 times and it's not enough. I was talking to my mom just 2 days ago. Somebody's hitting on her. An old boyfriend's coming back in her life. She's 80 years old. She's been married twice. I say, Mom, you're 80 years old. She says, if that's not bad enough, he's married. I said, Mom, what do you think? Why do you think he's calling you? Because his wife is giving him Viagra. It doesn't even end at 80. Desire is there, wanting to be satisfied. So if you have to have sex, after all of this, the Buddha said 4 things. He said, don't have sex with people who are married. It causes too much suffering. Don't have sex with people who are engaged. It causes too much suffering. Don't have sex with people who are being supported by their parents, children. It causes too much suffering. And don't have sex with people against their will. It causes too much suffering. Those are the 4 things he said about sex. Everything else was okay. Of course, you get into the city, state, and country mode, and we have laws about everything we do, and many. So I tell the young people I talk to, you know, if you can just abide by those 4 things, your sexual activity will have less suffering connected to it. But there will always be suffering ultimately. Now you might say to yourself, well, maybe the answer is not to have sex. Then I won't have to suffer. Well, actually, no, you'll just suffer in a different way. You'll suffer because you don't have sex. So when I get together with monks, we talk about how not to have sex. It's very cool. Now we come to right livelihood, which is part of this personal discipline category. Can we find a way to make a living and decrease suffering? Can we have right livelihood, if you will? And I was giving a talk at USC to some business majors. It was so much fun. And one of the guys was a Buddhist. And he says, it's okay for a Buddhist to make a lot of money? Doesn't sound like it's good to make a lot of money. I said, oh, yes. Make as much money as you can. Think how much more money you can give away then. So there's nothing wrong with money. The problem is owning the money. It's not using the money. Money seems to be energy to me. And that energy can transform a lot of things in a very special way. It can transform our hunger. It can transform our shelter. Can transform our lives if we use it and don't own it. So right livelihood is an important aspect of the Buddhist path. We want to do something that allows us to support our family, because most Buddhists aren't monks and nuns. We want to do something that allows us to have a lifestyle we feel comfortable in, but we want to do something that maybe decreases suffering as well. So these are all things that we're looking at as we start the Buddhist path. We accept the five precepts of a Buddhist. We look at the Eightfold Path, and we see that first personal discipline category, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and we try and apply that to how we live in the world. So morality is the foundation of Buddhism. And if you listen to a bunch of meditators, you never hear this stuff. But if you go back to the early Buddhist tradition of Theravada, there it is in neon lights, you know. Be skillful. Be skillful. That's the easiest way to reduce your suffering. And next, you go into meditation, the actual transformation of consciousness, to transform yourself from an imperfect human being to a perfect human being. And some religious traditions say that that is impossible because of something called original sin. And I've talked to a few Christians who just will deny the fact that anybody can become perfect. So let me define for you, according to Buddhism, what a perfect human being is. A perfect human being, instead of having lust, only has love. A perfect human being, instead of having greed, only has generosity. A perfect human being, instead of having anger and hatred, only has loving kindness and compassion. A perfect human being, instead of being deluded and ignorant, is full of wisdom and insight. And I think every human being has that potential to be perfect in that way. And that potential in Buddhism is called Buddha nature. Your potential for perfection. Each and every human being, I think, has one. I was at a Catholic Buddhist conference, and one of the priests came up to me and said, "You know, Reverend Kusla, I know you're Buddhist, but I see the spark of God in you." And I said, "Oh, thank you, Father. I see Buddha nature in you." So it's there. And Buddhism is designed not to give it to us. Buddhism is designed to make us realize we've already had it. It's always been there. We've always had as much love as we'll ever need. The problem was we had a little anger and hatred in the way. We've always had as much generosity as we'll ever need. We only have to get rid of all the greed that prevents this innate generosity from flowering. And I like that. That means we're already perfect. Right from day one. Just got a few things to get rid of. So Buddhism, the path of Buddhism, is a path of renunciation. Our job is not to gain anything. Our job is to get rid of the stuff that prevents our perfection from being realized. Anybody have any questions? Anybody stuck on some point I've talked about?
No, none.
It makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Yes?
The five precepts versus, it seems like part of the five precepts is a part of the eightfold path.
Yes. They are all of them. Except for intoxicants. So, does anybody know what's wrong in Buddhism with taking intoxicants? With having a couple beers with your burrito? What could possibly be wrong with that? Yes. No, you're just waiting for the answer? Okay. Well, it works like this. There's nothing wrong with intoxicants. Like beer and wine, food, you know? It's like, yeah, if you're in Germany or France, you're drinking it all the time. The problem in Buddhism with intoxication is it steals your wisdom. You can have a PhD from a name university and a six-pack of beer or some vodka. You become an imbecile. Wow. So the idea, we're working really hard on keeping this compassion and wisdom as our goal. And we're striving and getting close, and then all of a sudden we end up getting drunk at a party, and we go back five steps. You go, man. So what do? If you're taking the five precepts and you mess up, you retake them. Nothing happens to you. You don't, you know, all of a sudden the sky doesn't open up and lightning strikes you. You just look at yourself and go, I am unskillful. Wow, I thought I had it. I guess I'm not a Buddha yet. And you retake the five precepts. Yes.
I found myself thinking, well, maybe religion isn't the right word to apply to Buddhism. But I always think of religion as having some kind of higher, you know, a belief in a higher power.
Ah.
So do you ascribe to Buddhism as religion?
I think there are four kinds of Buddhism being practiced in America today. There's religious Buddhism. I ascribe to that. I'm a clergy in that part of it. There is lifestyle Buddhism. There is therapy Buddhism. And there's philosophical Buddhism. And so a lot of people come to Buddhism as a therapy. You know, they say, I just can't get along with my wife. I'm going to meditate. Because I know Buddhist meditation will make me peaceful and happy, and I'll see the perfection in her every day. Well, I would recommend that you go to a counselor. It's much faster. You know? And then you have lifestyle Buddhism. You know, and there are all these lifestyle Buddhists who can hardly wait for the Dalai Lama to come to town, because they're right in line for the first tickets, you know? And they have on their book stand next to their bed a couple little books on Buddhism, and they might have a picture of the Buddha someplace. And so those are like the lifestyle Buddhists. And then you have the scholar Buddhists. You have the philosophical Buddhists who don't practice Buddhism but love to read about Buddhism and can debate and dialogue about Buddhism all day long. But they don't practice. And then you have the religious Buddhist who looks at it as a path to salvation, a way of enhancing their life by having guidelines and knowing, or at least coming to the knowledge of what's important and what's not. Clarity, compassion. So I think there's a couple different ways of approaching Buddhism. Stephen Julius, when he called me up a couple days ago, he said, Kusla, you know there's something called Jubus? And I said, yeah. He says, how do you feel about that? You know, he's... I said, well, I don't think it works. And he says, why? I said, well, I think it takes an entire lifetime to get one religion down. And to mix religions, it seems to me like you're trying to be comfortable. You're taking a little bit of this and taking a little bit of that, and you're being comfortable with the religions. And when I look at religion as designed to change you. You're not designed to change the religion. So combining two or three religions because they seem to work together for you, I think is a problem. I don't think it works. And if you still think it works, I would have to ask you, where do you go when you die? You know, does half of you go to Buddhist heaven and the other half to wherever it is you go?
Is that the right question? What difference does it make for you?
I think it makes a big difference because we all have to die.
Yeah, I mean, that's a given.
Uh-huh. So where do you go? Okay, well, that's one way of looking at it. But I was never satisfied with that. And so I said to myself, does Buddhism have an afterlife? Does Buddhism have heaven? Am I doomed to go in Christian hell because I'm a Buddhist? And as it turns out, no. I don't even go to Christian hell or Christian heaven. I go to Buddhist heaven or Buddhist hell. We have over 30 heavens and over 30 hells. We have a lot of places to go. And we have specific practices to go to each one of them. We have a lot of work to do while we're alive so we can prepare to go to some place when we're dead. But that's not even our ultimate goal, heaven. You know why? Because heaven is temporary in Buddhism. It's not forever. It's a great place to be while you're there, but the karma that puts you in heaven wears out and you have to leave. And who would want to leave heaven? I don't know anybody. So you start to suffer again because they tell you it's time to go. And you say, I don't want to go. Yes, it's time to be reborn in another realm of existence. Wow. Bummer. Let me give you just a short Reader's Digest version of afterlife in Buddhism. It's called the Six Realms of Existence. The first one is the best heaven of all. If you can imagine what heaven might be like, this is it. It's perfect. The problem for a Buddhist in heaven is you can't do anything for anybody else and get merit and change your karma. Because you don't want to change anything. It's just perfect. So the karma that put you there eventually wears out. Your karma account goes dry. And you have to leave to acquire more karma to go back into heaven. The second heaven realm isn't quite as nice as the first one. And I call this the Donald Trump heaven realm. Because if you had one more building or one more wife, it would be a great heaven, but you never get it. So there's a little bit of desire attached to this heaven realm. The next realm of existence is the human realm. And that's where we all are. Whether you're Buddhist or not, we made it. And this is the best place for a Buddhist to be reborn, because this is where the Dharma is available to us. This is where we can acquire merit. We can do good actions. I should say skillful actions. So we can have skillful speech. We can acquire merit, which can be used in a future lifetime. We do have businessman's karma in Buddhism. Now, the first hell realm is the animal realm. And if you have animals, you're not going to say that's the hell realm. But you're probably really taking good care of those animals. And there are so many animals that aren't being taken good care of. At our center, I have a cat that a woman in our center used to have, but grew tired of it. So I'm taking care of the cat. He now lives with me and takes half of my bed every night. We have the center dog, which I feed and walk every day. So he thinks I own him. I think I'm just feeding him. We now have four feral cats that have found a way to our backyard that I'm feeding every day. So I'm buying 24 cans of cat food when I go to the store, and they have the dry food too. And they are so happy to see me in the backyard because they know it's feeding time. You know? So, and then I've got koi fish. I have like 50 koi fish that I take care of. And I feed them and I clean the filters and change the water. And I tell you, having a fish pond in the backyard is every day there's something wrong. It's hard to control water. So, what's wrong with being an animal? Why is that the hell realm, the first hell realm? Because if you describe what an animal does, all they do is they eat, they sleep, they have sex, and they're totally confused. Probably me at 16. But, you know, it's like, okay, they don't have a chance to practice generosity and compassion. They can't acquire wisdom. But as a Buddhist, we feel if we bring them in contact with the Dharma, if they smell the incense, if their eye falls on an image of the Buddha, if their ear hears Buddhist chanting, it's placing a seed in their consciousness that they will be reborn as a human being. Now, we have 30 residents that live full-time at our center. I'm thinking if some of these animals are reborn, they can come back and be a resident and help us pay the mortgage. Very cool. So, the next hell realm is called the hungry ghost realm. And this is where you get this hell realm body. It's 15 feet tall and a pinhole for a mouth. And no matter how hard you try to put the food through the mouth, the stomach never gets filled. You're always hungry. You always have so much desire that can't be satisfied. It's very uncomfortable. And finally, the last hell realm of all, the worst one of all, where you have hell bodies that look just like you. And you're walking through a beautiful forest with leaves that suddenly turn into razor blades and fall from the tree and cut you into 1,000,000 pieces, and you cry and scream in pain and agony, and you're resurrected right on the spot to be killed again and again and again, purifying the karma that puts you in hell, and then eventually you'll be reborn out of hell into another realm of existence. It's very dramatic and wonderful to read. And what I found is heaven is up and hell is down, even in Buddhism. I'm thinking, why is that? Why does heaven have to be up? Why couldn't it be right or left? But it's not. So, I think afterlife is really important. The reason I came to my religion is because I was going to die and I wanted someplace to go. And my work with the hospital sort of confirms that. That people who are terminal don't want to be told there's no place to go. Even if there isn't. I don't know if there's any place to go. I can only tell you what Buddhism says. And that works for me. But if you're dying, you know, it's nice to have someplace to go. So I think, and this is just my opinion, and I got this opinion from going to the Orange County Coroner's Office and seeing dead people for the first time, which was pretty interesting. We had 6 dead people that day. I had never seen 1 dead person, let alone 6. I got to see autopsies. I got to see inside the human body, and it's beautiful. there's fuchsia and blues and reds and there's bright yellows. That's the cholesterol. It's great to look at all this stuff. And this woman I was looking at, she was 30 years old. She had gone to a party. She had had a drug alcohol overdose and died at the party. And now, I failed to mention that I'm a volunteer police chaplain in Garden Grove. And so the police chaplains got to go to the Orange County to see dead people. So sometimes we're called on scene to care and comfort. So I looked at her, and you know what I noticed about her? You could tell where her watch was. She had a suntan. Her fingernails had just been polished. She had prepared to go to this party. She hadn't prepared to die. She was prepared to have a good time and then continue her life. But it didn't work out that way. And then there was a 15-year-old boy. There was a 54-year-old man with who had drank too much. Cirrhosis of the liver killed him in his easy chair. Three old guys who died because they're old. And you know what thought came to my mind? Did any of them, while they were alive, go to their rabbi, their priest, their monk, their imam, their minister, their pastor, and say, as a religious person, how am I supposed to die? You tell me how to live. You tell me what I need to do to have a good life, but do you tell me how to die? You know? And in Buddhism, we talk about that a lot. We try to die into every moment and be reborn in the next. We see consciousness as being born, existing, and dying. We see our bodies as being born, existing, and dying, and being born, existing, and dying. We have this concept of rebirth, which drives people nuts because they can't believe in rebirth. It's so foreign to the Western culture, and I guess Christianity. I've heard some of the early Christians believed in reincarnation, but that seems to be out of the picture now. So they say, how can I believe in rebirth, Reverend Kusala, if I want to be a Buddhist? Because it doesn't make any sense to me at all. And I said, well, don't think about past life and future life. Think about this life. Think about when you were 10 years old. Get a picture of yourself when you were 10 years old and go and look in the mirror now and ask yourself where that person is today. That person died. They're gone. And any memories you have are the ghosts of that person living after them. How many times have we been reborn? When I was 20, I was a much different person than I am now. I had polyester shirts, bell-bottom slacks, a lot of hair, a blow dryer. I was looking pretty good. I look in the mirror now and I go, geez, what happened? You know? So that guy that I used to be when I was 20, when I was 30, when I was 40, they're all dead and buried. And if I have issues to resolve with those guys, I have a memorial service for them. You know, because sometimes they messed up, and I'm carrying their baggage. And I got this part of my life to worry about now. So I just, you know, yeah, I bury them. So I think in just one lifetime, we've had many rebirths. And if you can figure out how to die well at 20, you can be reborn well at 30. Most cool. Our skill level increases dramatically each time we go through rebirth. So I try to be, I want to say practical about it. I look at all the people in the world. In fact, there's a story I heard about Abraham Lincoln. And he gave this very profound speech. Moved a lot of people in the hall. And he sat down next to his wife, Mary. And he started to cry. Just a little tear came to his eye. And Mary looked at him and said, oh, that was a good speech, Abe. Why are you so sad? And Abraham Lincoln said, he looked in the audience and realized in 100 years, everyone would be dead. And it made him sad. And I guess any of us could look at any audience and say in 100 years, you know. So isn't this life special? I think so. Is it good to plan ahead? Maybe. Buddhism emphasizes life and death with equal intensity. If you can learn to die well, you can learn to live well. And every day is a special day. It becomes magical. I'm here again in a different way every day. One of my favorite commercials from a few years ago was a cornflakes commercial. Taste it again for the first time. Let's do that with our life. Let's taste our life again for the first time. Every day is the first time. Very cool. So that's how I look at it. I hope that didn't make you uncomfortable. Good. Okay. Yes.
I have a question about this idea of attaining nirvana.
Okay.
Is it a state or is it a realm?
Very good. Well, you know, I'm going to do something the Buddha didn't. I'm going to talk about nirvana. The Buddha was asked many times to explain it and to define it, and he never did. And that bothered me, because I always like to ask questions and I expected answers. So I had to figure out nirvana for myself. And this is how I think it works. Nirvana is a radical transformation of consciousness. It has nothing at all to do with your body. Our bodies are rooted in samsara. Samsara is the realm of birth and death. But does our consciousness have to die? And as it turns out, if we transform our consciousness in nirvana, we will exist forever. How is that possible? Because nirvana is not dependent on creation. Do you realize, and I'm sure you do, that everything in this world was created? There is not one thing in this world that was not created. Now, as a Buddhist, I don't have to define first cause. I can believe, if I want to, that God was the first cause. If I want to, I can believe in the Big Bang Theory. If I want to, I can believe in the Flying Spaghetti Monster, which actually I prefer. So, creation. What's the problem with creation? It always ends in death. Always. Not one thing doesn't die if it was created. So, I think the Buddha saw this as a problem. And he looked at the realms of existence as problematic as well. Because it's hard to know which realm you're going to be reborn into because of all the past karma you can't remember you've done. Is there a solution? And I think he found it. And the solution is nirvana. So when he achieved nirvana at the age of 35, he ended his suffering forever. Good thing. I want to ask this question, though. Can anybody give me a definition of suffering? Because, you know, I talk about this a lot, and I just assume everybody knows what suffering is. Is pain and suffering the same thing? Anybody have? No. We have one person shaking their head. Absolutely not. Okay. Well, let me share with you the best definition I've heard of suffering. And this was a seventh grader in Glendale, California. Her name was Esmeralda. And I was giving a talk in her history class. And I gave my talk, and at the end of my talk, she raised her little hand and said, Reverend Kusla, I now understand the difference between pain and suffering. Suffering happens when you don't want to have the pain. Suffering happens when you have a Ford and want a Honda. Suffering happens when you want things to be different than they are. So in one respect, Buddhism is about coming to a profound acceptance of the way things are. Right now. Seeing the perfection in every moment. So, the Buddha, in his nirvana, ended his suffering. He came to a profound acceptance of the way things are. He ended his karma. And this is so important. Because in Buddhism, we do not have a soul. And this may come as a shock to you. And if you want to have a soul, I'm not saying you don't. But I'm saying in Buddhism, we had some problems with the soul. And this wasn't the Christian concept of soul, this was the Hindu concept of soul. And the problems with having a soul in the Hindu way is accountability, taking responsibility. If you believed in eternalism, you may not be too serious about any one lifetime. You may end up doing some things that are pretty unskillful and say, I'll make up for it in my future lifetimes. I don't have to worry. If you have this sort of nihilistic or nihilistic approach to life, you might say, hey, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to feed the trees when I die so I can do anything I want. The Buddha took a middle path. He said, if you have a soul, that's not who you really are. Wow. That's not who you really are. He was saying that we do not have an independent essence. He was saying we are conditional. He ended his karma. In Buddhism, what is being reborn, lifetime to lifetime, is not a soul. It is karmic energy. It is a process that transmigrates from one lifetime to the next. When he ended his karma, he ended any possibility of transmigration into a future lifetime. People ask me why I'm here. How did I get born? I tell them, my parents had sex, I had karma. That's why I'm here. My job is to end my karma. I can't do anything about my parents having sex. But if I end my karma, I'll never have to be reborn again. And if I end my karma in nirvana, I can exist because of nirvana and not because of creation. Nirvana is uncreated. It's unborn. It's undying. You might use that definition as a supreme being. But we would say this state of consciousness, this realm of consciousness, whatever it is unborn. And that's our goal, to be uncreated. Pretty abstract goal, I must say. So if you don't want to go there, the easier goal in Buddhism is to just be happy. Just be content. Just be peaceful. And then maybe a couple lifetimes down the line, you'll want to be free. But we don't encourage people to be free right away, because most people think they are already. In America, we're free to choose between the red one and the blue one. I want more freedom than that. But I got to figure out how to be free. I got to figure out how to get past my conditioning, myself, if you will. Who's making the choices? Do I really have a choice? Or don't I? Do I have free choice? Does anybody here have free choice? Or do we have these habitual patterns that we keep falling into? We have tradition. We have rules and regulations. We have right and wrong, good and bad. We have political systems. All of them are deciding for us at some level, I suppose, what our choice is. I was thinking about this just the other day. When I was young, my mom made all my choices for me. She spent all my time for me. She said, you got to go to school, you got to clean your room, you got to make your bed, you got to take out the trash once in a while. Those choices are not being made by you. They're being made by me. So when I left home and thought I was going to be free, well, I was free to work so I could find a place to live. I was free to work so I could buy food. I was free. Where did the freedom come from? And then I thought to myself, can my body ever be free? And the answer I came up with was no, absolutely not. My body requires constant maintenance, cleaning and grooming and occasionally medical care. And even that sometimes doesn't work. I know when I was young, I was really attached to being attractive. And I worked hard. At my current age, I just don't want to be repulsive. I've come a long way. But my body will never be free. So the only thing left is my mind. I can have a free consciousness and a free mind. I can be free from fear. I gave a talk after 9/11 at a church in Wilshire. And I said, the only terror we really have to worry about is right inside of here. Well, everybody freaked out when I said that. They said, but all those people out there. No, but they aren't terrorists. The only terror is inside our head. It's our freedom. We are afraid to be free. We want to be in the prison of security. We like that. And we're willing to give up all our freedom to be secure. And then I thought to myself, can we ever be secure in this world? The Buddha said, absolutely not. Mother Nature is out to get you. You may think Mother Nature is there to cuddle and nurture you, but try going out to the forest and living off the land. If the snakes and bears don't get you, the poison ivy will. You know, there's nothing kind about this world, I don't think. I don't think there's any ultimate security in this world, that every day is special and a miracle. And to be free means to have the courage to go out and being willing to die every moment, but also being willing to live every moment, I think. So, as we transform consciousness in nirvana, it first becomes more comfortable for us to live in the world. Ultimately, we become free in this world. And that's what the Buddha figured out. But not everybody wants to be free. I was talking to a group, and I said, if I could guarantee you nirvana tonight, would you take it? How many hands do I see? Guaranteed nirvana. Not one hand went up. So I asked one fellow, I said, well, why don't you want nirvana tonight? He said, I'm planning on buying a car. I want to get that first. I said, okay. So that's sort of how it works, you know. Until we come to a place in our life, I did at 28, when I realized I was going to die, my mortality became real. Until we come to a place in our life, I think, where suffering is oppressive, where there's no comfort zone left, we don't hear the message clearly from the Buddha. And the Buddha's first message was, this is why we suffer. And if you're not suffering, you don't ever need me in your life. You know? So if I do a wedding, and I've been lucky enough to be invited to officiate at weddings, I don't have much to say. Everybody's really happy. I have cake and I leave, you know? But when the divorce happens, hey, Kusala, I go, yeah, how can I help? Any other... any other questions? Or yes?
Back to that same question.
Okay.
Why have the five precepts and the Eightfold Path? What is the purpose of following the Eightfold Path gets you to nirvana?
The purpose of the Eightfold Path is to allow us to realize our perfection, to realize we've already achieved nirvana.
What do the five precepts do that is different than that?
The five precepts allow us to have a foundation for our meditation practice. There are times in meditation, and I'll talk about this next week, when we become selfless, when we transcend self, time and place. At those moments, you may not know what is skillful and what is not. At those moments, you may be ultimately unskillful, because all censorship has stopped. The foundation of the five precepts, and if you're a monastic living in a religious community, allow you to go through those stages of transformation and transcendence without hurting yourself or others. So it's very important to have the five precepts. It also allows you to live in community in harmony. If you're practicing those five precepts, you can live any place in the world. And people will invite you to stay. You know, that's a special thing. So, yes.
Two questions. How can you obtain a transcript of your remarks?
Okay.
And second, is there any primer or Buddhism that you would recommend?
Yes, and that is my ultimate goal, which
I learned by reading, not by listening.
Exactly. Well, my goal is this. My goal is tomorrow I don't have any presentations to make. I have no commitments to fulfill. I'm going to start putting the web page together. And what I've said tonight will be an MP3 file. On my personal Buddhist website called urbandharma.org, I have free ebooks on Buddhism. Go figure. And you can download as many of those as you want at no cost.
Perfect Dharma.
It's called Urban Dharma. Urbandharma.org. Urbandharma.org. It's right. Okay, it's listed on there. I will also recommend some books from Amazon.com that I have found useful in my understanding of Buddhism. If you go into a bookstore and look for a book on Buddhism, you'll find 10,000 these days. It's an amazing challenge to find the right one. And a lot of them are for experienced meditators or practitioners, and some are for beginners. Some have misinformation, some don't. So I picked a few that I've enjoyed that have for me been truthful in their explanation of Buddhism. So I'm going to put together this web page, and then I'm going to email the link to Rabbi Stein, and he said he would attach it to his website, the Wilshire Boulevard website. So you'll be able to go there, and if you want to listen to me again, download the MP3 file, but you also have other references too. So it's a very complicated philosophy, religion, therapy in the beginning. It goes against common sense in some ways. It goes against what we've been taught is true and useful. And it took me a while to see the thread that in all the aspects of Buddhism I've come in contact with, there's a thread that runs through all of them, whether it be Tibetan Buddhism, whether it be Theravada Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. There's something there. And that took a while. I can't tell you what it is. If you study long enough, you'll find it too.
I'm asking, how many Buddhists in the world?
I don't know. There's more and more. How was that? Okay, great. That's really a good question. How could there be more and more? Well, I think what's happening, more and more people are being reborn out of hell onto earth, and they're suffering, and they look for Buddhism. So, and the ones that are being reborn out of heaven, coming back to earth, don't need Buddhism. So we have more hell beings on earth now than we ever have had before. Maybe. Yes.
To say that Buddhism is theistic in the sense that it's an organized religion, but not deistic in the terms of recognizing a one God?
A really good question, or good statement. I look at it this way. Buddhism is non-theistic. What does non-theistic mean? It means we don't have to believe in God. The Buddha was a theist his whole life. The Buddha died a theist. But the Buddha found there was one thing God couldn't do. And that was end human suffering. So if you become a Buddhist, you're not becoming a Buddhist to find God. I've met many Buddhists who believe in God, but not because of Buddhism.
That's not the purpose of Buddhism.
I've met some Buddhists that don't believe in God, but that's not because of Buddhism either. I've met some Buddhists that don't know that is because of Buddhism.
A lot of what I read now says God is dead, God is dead, God is dead. And that doesn't fit in with my religion. I'm Jewish.
But, yeah.
If you were a Buddhist, it wouldn't make any difference whether God was dead.
Dead or alive.
Yes.
Exactly.
Am I saying that correctly?
You're saying that absolutely correctly. And what I found when I became a Buddhist is it lifted a burden off my shoulder. The burden was that I needed to believe in God or I needed not to believe in God. That burden was lifted.
I see.
Now, it didn't matter if I did or not. I could listen to people who believed in God all day long and agree with them. And I could listen to people who didn't believe in God and say, fine, that's wonderful. And I could listen to people who don't know and say, yeah. So I didn't have to have this feeling that there was something greater that I needed to relate to or have a relationship with. I realized that in Buddhism, my job was to come back to my senses. My job was to ground myself in the present moment experience of my life. And that's been healthy for me. I'm not saying it's healthy for everybody. It's been healthy for me. Yes?
I can't help but wonder, though, can you apply the word burden to the whole concept of this afterlife? It seems very challenging. It's kind of a leap of faith the same way. Believing in a God might be challenging.
For me, it wasn't. For me, believing in afterlife was...
I understand when you're alive, the idea of rebirth. But then the whole idea of different... heaven and hell, and it's sort of an unknown. It's behind that curtain. We don't really.
You don't know.
Yeah.
No. What?
Same way you don't have evidence of many things that other people, other thoughts, believe in. So.
Exactly. So when somebody says to me,
that idea of, how do I know that that's really true?
Exactly. So I say, I know this to be Buddhism. That's good enough. I don't have to say it's true. I don't have to tell you I think it's true. I have to tell you that this is what Buddhism says. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. And then it's up to you. So when people say it's true, I get nervous, Because my truth may be different than their truth. And there's relative truth and there's ultimate truth. Which truth are you talking about? You know, and so when they say this is how I understand Buddhism, I go, yes. There's a certain comfort that comes with that explanation. And that's how I understand Buddhism. So I don't have any issues with that. I'm getting ready for heaven.
No, you know, there are burdens that you feel, that the way you describe other religions, there's a burden involved in. So you don't see it as a burden. It's just a fact that you accept, or a part of it you accept. You don't feel, you have to work at thinking about it.
You know what? The word isn't accept. The word that I would use would be confidence.
Okay.
My faith transformed into confidence. And I only had faith, as much faith as it takes to take the first step. Mm-hmm. Any more faith than that, I didn't have. But I had one step of faith. And the second step was confidence. And I went, yeah, that's it. Does that make sense, sort of? Okay.
Yes. Your five precepts that you talked about,
yeah,
are universal.
They can be. I was at a mosque in Chino, Founders Day celebration. They invited me to speak. I said, what am I going to speak about? I'll speak about morality. So I spoke about the five precepts. Afterwards, they had a wonderful lunch. I sat down. One fellow said, you know, we have four of the five. I said, cool. I didn't ask which one they didn't have.
That was wise.
Yeah, it was wise. So it sounds like it should be universal. But I was at St. John's Abbey in Collegeville, Minnesota, a Buddhist Catholic conference on celibacy. Nothing like talking to a bunch of old monks about celibacy, huh? And we were invited to the Eucharist, and they had wine. Hey, that sort of breaks the fifth precept. So I said, what kind of wine do you drink? And they said, well, we don't drink wine. Well, what's in the bottle? It's the blood of Christ. I said, okay. Not going any further than that. So, you know, this thing about drinking, a lot of religions, drinking isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's a social thing. It brings people together. What Buddhism says, and it's not to say that Buddhists don't drink, because it's a training precept. It's not a commandment or vow. And so in Buddhism, the idea is to transform your consciousness, and intoxicants muddy your consciousness. So it's more than a social thing in Buddhism. So I wish all the religions had those five precepts. This would be a much different world. Maybe. And maybe not. You know?
You said you were born. Your parents had sex.
I had karma.
You had karma. With cloning, how does that apply?
You know, that's a really good question, and I haven't found anything in the ancient Buddhist texts about cloning yet. But when I do...
Is there a theory that's applied in Buddhism today? That it's a logic that, like, the Dalai Lama's his infinite wisdom of...
Well, you know, if you just want an off-the-top-of-the-head response, I would say any birth leads to suffering, cloned or not. So, you know, it's not necessarily a good thing. It's just more suffering in the world. Yeah. Okay, how are we doing on time? Are we over time, huh? Well, thank you very much for paying such close attention to what I had to say. And I'm looking forward to next week, which will be the meditation week. And maybe we can practice a little meditation as well. So have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Thank you.